This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with presidential politics. The three Democratic candidates debated over the weekend, and today the very large Republican field got a little smaller. All this with just a month and a half to go before the Iowa caucuses and then the all-important New Hampshire primary. Well, joining us now with more is WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. He's been following the action in New Hampshire and beyond. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
So let's start with today's news. Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, dropped out of the race. I mean, his campaign has struggled with not all that much money and obviously low poll numbers. But does his departure do anything to the field?
Okay, so I'm going to give you two answers. The unserious answer comes from our friend Ken Rutan, the political junkie, who said Graham's withdrawal only adds to speculation that George Pataki will be the nominee. Okay, so we'll get that out of the way. The serious answer, as you suggested, his campaign really struggled. He was confined to that undercard debate table. He cited that as a reason for having difficulty getting his message out. But he's an interesting story because in any other campaign year that didn't feature this huge Republican field and the big Donald Trump shadow, someone like Graham would have been a contender, I think. He's a respected senator, serious foreign policy credentials, a record of working across party lines. People like John McCain supported him. McCain said Republicans lost our most qualified, thoughtful, fearless, and honest presidential candidate. Among the issues that Graham pushed was a pretty hawkish approach to the issue in Syria and Iraq. He wanted to send 20,000 troops to fight ISIS. Here's a clip from his announcement today.
4 months ago, at the very first debate, I said that any candidate who did not understand that we need more American troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria to defeat ISIL was not ready to be commander-in-chief. Today, most of my fellow candidates have come to recognize this is what's needed to secure our homeland.
So he may have moved the needle there, but he still had to drop out of the race, Anthony. All this comes as Graham, if I understand correctly, he worked very hard in New Hampshire, though.
So he made, to this point, more trips to New Hampshire than any other candidate in the field. Huh. And by the way, George Pataki is right behind him in terms of numbers of trips, but it did him no good. And it's just a reminder that personal face time matters only to a point. Much more important is money and organization. Graham lacked both of those. But here's how his departure could affect the race. He's very popular in South Carolina, where he's been elected senator. He's got a strong grassroots network down there, which holds the primary right after New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So his followers will be courted in a big way by other Republicans. So in that sense, his endorsement, which he hasn't made, could make a difference in this race down the line a bit.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so let's cross the aisle here and talk a little bit about the Democrats, who held their last debate of the year in Manchester on Saturday. And it seems as if all three of them, Anthony, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley, pretty spirited debate.
I agree. It was the first debate among the Democrats since the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino. So that issue dominated a lot of the conversation. And Hillary Clinton, because of her long experience as Secretary of State, you would think that would have given her the edge. Sanders has been somewhat reluctant to talk about this on the campaign trail, preferring instead to really focus on economic issues, economic disparity, that kind of stuff. But on Saturday, he really sparred with Clinton on her record, including her support for the war in Iraq, her push to intervene in Libya, her push to force President Assad out of Syria, all of which he says creates instability and political vacuum in the region and actually creates a haven for terrorist groups like ISIS. Here's a bit of what he said.
And I say this with due respect, that I worry too much that Secretary Clinton is too much into regime change and a little bit too aggressive without knowing what the unintended consequences might be.
You know, with all due respect, Senator, you voted for regime change with respect to Libya. All of these are very difficult issues. I know that. I've been dealing with them for a long time.
So good comeback there by Clinton, reminding people of her experience. But this debate really opened up some light between these two candidates, in particular around this argument of whether it makes sense to try to force Syrian President Assad out of office and fight ISIS at the same time, which is what Clinton proposes. Sanders says going after Assad doesn't make sense. The U.S. should focus on ISIS.
Mm. Well, so ISIS and terrorism really dominating the discussion there. But there was also talk about a the economy and jobs. I mean, who had the advantage in the debate there?
Well, I think they both did pretty well on this. They disagreed, too. I mean, what impressed me about this debate is there were real differences, and they talked about these differences in interesting ways. They disagreed on the economy and taxes. Clinton promised not to raise taxes on the middle class ever. And, you know, let's say she does get elected. I'm wondering if that comes back to haunt her. Right. Sanders said he would raise taxes for the right program, like paid medical leave. On health care, Clinton wants to fix what she calls glitches in the Affordable Care Act. Sanders, as we know and have reported, wants a single-payer system. He wants also to tax street Wall Street speculation and make all public colleges and universities free. Clinton says that would cost too much. And then there was this question from ABC's David Muir, one of the moderators, which opened up a really interesting conversation. Here's how he started it with Clinton.
The last time you ran for president, Fortune magazine put you on its cover with the headline, Business Loves Hillary, pointing out your support for many CEOs in corporate America. I'm curious, 8 years later, should corporate America love Hillary Clinton?
Everybody should.
that was a pretty good moment. Answer, yeah. That was a good answer. But it points to a big difference between these two candidates, because critics on the left fault Clinton as being too close to Wall Street. She's accepted millions in dollars in speaking fees and many millions more in campaign contributions over the years from Wall Street investment firms. And by contrast, Sanders has not. And so this allowed him to sort of sharpen this difference Saturday night. Listen to how he answered the question.
And will corporate America love a President Sanders?
No, I think they won't. So Hillary and I have a difference. The CEOs of large multinationals may like Hillary. They ain't going to like me. And Wall Street is going to like me even less.
Yeah. Get it? Could he be any clearer?
No. So two good actually answers there. So you're saying from both Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But what about Governor Martin O'Malley? I mean, we haven't even mentioned his name yet. He's pretty much been a non-factor in this race so far.
Yeah, but on Saturday night, he really made his presence known. He was sort of like the Energizer bunny, almost like the uninvited Energizer bunny. He kept sort of breaking into the campaign. He criticized both Clinton and Sanders on gun control, accusing them of flip-flopping, which earned him a rebuke from Sanders, who said, "Now calm down, Martin." On foreign policy, he said at one point, "Let me offer a perspective from a younger generation," which earned groans from many Clinton and Sanders supporters in the audience. And he went after both of them on the economy. Listen to this.
We're not going to make wages go up for everyone by either trying to replace American capitalism with socialism, which, by the way, the rest of the world is moving away from, nor will we fix it by submitting to sort of Wall Street-directed crony capitalism.
Interesting. So as we head into the holiday and then towards the Iowa caucuses, Anthony, and then, of course, after that, New Hampshire primary, where do you think the race stands now? And the perennial question, did the debate actually change the dynamic in any way?
I don't think it did. I think both candidates, I'm going to focus on Sanders and Clinton. They did what they needed to do. Clinton needed to maintain her momentum and really look past Sanders and toward the Republicans. She did that, and I think she did it pretty well. In fact, some of the sharpest language in the debate was aimed at Donald Trump. Martin O'Malley called him a fascist billionaire with a big mouth. And here's what Hillary Clinton said about Trump.
Mr. Trump has a great capacity to use bluster and bigotry to inflame people and to make them think there are easy answers to very complex questions.
Now, Sanders, for his part, needed to really continue to sharpen his differences with Clinton on the economy and on foreign policy. And it's really important that he do well in New Hampshire. He needed to do that. This is the one state he's leading in. He admits on the campaign trail his only path to victory is to win Iowa, where he's behind, and then New Hampshire. So he absolutely has to win New Hampshire. So, you know, a strong debate in the last debate of the year in New Hampshire was important. I think he did that. And Martin O'Malley, well, you know, he did a good job reminding us that he's still there.
As did Lindsey Graham for a while,
yeah,
until
that's
today.
Right. That's right.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Thanks so much, Anthony.
You're welcome.
Well, for those of you who care to look or listen, there exists some very insightful political analysis out there. You just heard some of it from Anthony. But if you take a look right now at what most of the media are talking about, it's pretty much just one thing.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
They are going to people, showing videos of Donald Trump insulting Islam and Muslims in order to recruit.
You would carpet bomb where ISIS is, not a city. The object is to kill the ISIS terrorists, to make it. Listen, ISIS is gaining strength.
And I say this with due respect, that I worry too much that Secretary Clinton is too much into regime change.
So lots and lots of boisterous debates amongst both Democrats and Republicans, which should be the sign of a healthy democracy, right? Well, our next guest says that really what we have is a dangerously thin political market, and that is dangerous for American democracy. Karthik Ramana is an associate professor at the Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Political Standards: Corporate Interest, Ideology, and Leadership in the Shaping of Accounting Rules for the Market Economy. And he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Megna.
So you make an argument that what we need is maybe less bluster in televised debate and more debate on some of the most, I don't want to call it boring, but some people may popularly believe the boring topics that never get asked in things like presidential debates.
That's right. I call these areas thin political markets, but these are some of the most complex and critical areas of our rulemaking infrastructure. This is where the institutions that define our democratic capitalist society are structured. And oftentimes, these are the areas where you don't see the kind of raucous debate that we just witnessed in the context of the presidential campaign.
Now, when you say thin political markets, are they thin because there aren't very many players in it? Are they thin because there isn't much interest? Are they thin because no one even really understands what these political markets do or are?
They're thin for two key reasons. On the one hand, you've got the knowledge that's necessary to determine outcomes in this area concentrated in the hands of a very small group of players. And the kind of issues that I study, which is technical rules that determine how corporations report their profits or their financial statements, there's usually somewhere between 5 and 50 people in the world that truly understand each of the specific issues that I study.
In the whole world.
Indeed.
5 to 50 people amongst the 7+ billion on the planet.
Indeed. And that's because we're talking about very specialized areas of rulemaking infrastructure. Now, on different issues, we have different sets of experts. And so one of the reasons why we have this kind of specialization is because, of course, you know, you don't have anyone who is an expert across a broad range of issues. And as we get into narrower and narrower areas, the number of experts starts getting fewer. And the other issue here that's really important is that the kind of expertise they bring to the table is what we call tacit knowledge. That means it's learning by doing. It's not the kind of knowledge that, you know, me as a professor would bring to the classroom by lecturing in front of the classroom. Rather, it's the knowledge that comes from deep expertise. So when you're thinking about, say, accounting rules for mergers and acquisitions, investment bankers are the ones that truly understand this issue because they live and breathe the stuff and they're really good at it.
But that automatically and immediately presents the problem of self-policing.
Indeed. And this is where the other aspect or other dimension that characterizes thin political markets becomes important. Look, there are lots of areas of the economy that are dominated by experts. I mean, Social Security is one, Medicare is the other. But these are issues that are in the salience, in the minds of the general public. You know, you have conversations about this in cocktail parties, in civil society. What that does is it creates an incentive for the media, it creates an incentive for politicians to intermediate in these issues. In thin political markets, like accounting rulemaking, you know, it's quite frankly, as you said earlier, possibly a boring area.
Except for the fact that today, in this day and age, accounting, corporate accounting rulemaking actually does affect all of us. I mean, most people, most working people in this day and age have 401ks. Their retirement is in the stock market. Those equities are attached to corporations that if they're not properly accounting their own activities, 2008 rolls around all over again.
Absolutely. These kinds of thin political markets, if they're left unpoliced, if they're left unmonitored, can bring all kinds of damages to the economy and to society and to the legitimacy of capitalism at the end of the day.
Okay, so hold that thought, because that's really one of the underlying lessons from your book here. But you talked about learning by doing. Let's learn by example a little bit, because I'd love to hear a particular example of things that happen in corporate accounting that sort of feed into this idea, I'll call it, you know, the perverse incentives around thin political markets as you describe them. Because you've written about accounting rules around mergers and acquisitions that have to do with what's called goodwill. Explain what goodwill is in terms in a merger.
So in a corporate merger, oftentimes the acquiring firm pays more than the current value of the assets less liabilities. And the reason why you pay more is because you hope by bringing the two companies together, you're going to generate all kinds of value. You're going to find new ways in which to generate profits. And so you pay a premium. And that premium is what accountants call goodwill. So that's a really important part of a merger. If you look at the volume of merger activity in the U.S. over the last 20 years, it exceeds about $20 trillion with a T. And about half of that value tends to be goodwill.
So half of that value is a thing that actually can't be quantified in numbers, in commonly accepted numbers like assets and liabilities and profits and revenues, etc.
Indeed. It can't be quantified easily, but it has to be quantified because real money is being paid for that.
Otherwise, why do the merger, right, if there's no goodwill?
In fact. And so what the accounting system is trying to do, or what the accounting system should do, is create a way to hold acquiring managers accountable for that goodwill.
Okay.
Right? And so what you'd like for them to do is, what you'd like for the accounting system to do is to be able to recognize the expense that companies have incurred by paying for all that goodwill. Unfortunately, and this was some of the issues that came out of the book that I wrote, the current system we have for goodwill accounting is such that managers have a lot of flexibility in the timing when they recognize the expenditure associated with goodwill.
To the point where you gave an example of mergers such as the one with Cisco, where 95%, do I have that number right? Am I remembering that correctly? 95% of the overall value of the deal was in goodwill. Is that right?
So this was at the time when Cisco was lobbying for these rule changes. This was back in 2000 when we were trying to put in place new rules for goodwill. And remember, 2000 was at the height of the dot-com economy. Cisco was at the time the most valuable company in the world. And Cisco is a company where acquisitions are central to the strategy. Cisco effectively outsources its research and development by acquiring leading companies. And it's very good at integrating them. Yes, and at the time that it was lobbying for these rule changes that delayed accountability for goodwill, 95% of its acquisition value, by the admission of its senior executive that was doing the lobbying, came from goodwill.
Huh. So to get back to your point, your bigger point here, I didn't actually have a chance to do this today, but I'm going to hazard a guess that if I looked outside of the highly specialized financial media at that time, in the year 2000, that I probably wouldn't have found all that many media stories or journalism stories about Cisco lobbying for goodwill changes.
Yeah, even in the financial press, the kind of articles, the kind of coverage we see on these issues tends to be at a very general level. It tends to be at a very high level that avoids a lot of the specifics, in part because, as we said earlier, the specifics are complex. The specifics are oftentimes perceived as boring. But of course, we know the devil is in the details, and that's where the lobbying happens. That's where the capacity to engineer rules of the game in the favor to favor a few, that's where that happens.
Right. So this gets me back to this idea of perverse incentives when it comes to how politics interacts with things like corporate accounting and the so-called, you know, boring topics that we don't spend all that much time thinking about, maybe, but should, especially if they're, you know, in the trillions of dollars when measurable impact. Because you've written that basically those 5 to 50 individuals in the entire world who have enough expertise in order to be policymakers on it, those are also the same people who have the greatest incentive to basically rig the outcome in their own interest, though.
Yeah, and it's important to recognize it's not the same 5 to 50 people on different issues, right? On different issues, there are different experts. And when you happen to be the expert on a particular issue, it's not surprising that you show up to the table. But of course, the nature of the issue is so specialized that there's no one sitting across the table from you. And then there's a question of, you have a particular worldview, you have a particular way in which you'd like the world to work, and perhaps not surprisingly, you advance that. But I think it's important to clarify that it's not always that the people who are showing up at the table have some sort of nefarious objective, or at least explicitly nefarious objective right off the bat. Oftentimes, it's that, you know, they have a particular worldview. They are surrounded by people who think like them. They're surrounded by people who share the same way in which they look at the problem.
But groupthink doesn't have to be nefarious to still be bad, though.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, so if you happen to be someone who has spent your career at an investment bank and you come to view the world through the lens of investment banking, and here's your chance to shape the rules of the game, even if you don't have an explicit motive to do this in your self-interest, the kind of positions you take, you know, naturally maybe tend toward ways in which they would reflect the interests of investment banks and of investment bankers. And so you get this, what I call ideological or cognitive capture. You start to view the world in a way that is most familiar to you. And because you don't have the kind of vibrant debate, the boisterous debate that we saw in the presidential campaign, you're oftentimes not exposed to competing points of view, or even to people questioning that paradigm, questioning that worldview that you might have.
Is another way of putting this what Bernie Sanders says, is that Washington is owned by the corporate elite who've rigged the system in favor, in their own favor? Is this as close as Harvard Business School is going to get?
I wouldn't go quite so far, and I'm not quite sure what Bernie Sanders has said on this issue. But I think the kind of issue that I'm trying to raise in this book and by writing this book is to say that it's important to bring more voices in. It's important to bring debate into these issues. So, you know, as an academic, I write papers or I write books. And when I do that, I go to other universities and I present this work. And usually in these academic seminars, I'm challenged. I'm asked difficult questions. Not because, you know, people want to be mean, not because people want to criticize my work, but because they're trying to make my work better. They're trying to make me more intellectually rigorous and in the process make the work better. It's that spirit of questioning. It's that spirit of debate in the context of thin political markets that I think we need more of.
I mean, in fact, you say that the system that we have now, as it has emerged, actually undermines the critical institutions of capitalism.
So if we don't have that kind of debate, if we don't have that kind of structuring where we create a climate where regulatory institutions are questioning the assumptions, are questioning the paradigms of the experts that inform the nature of regulations, then indeed, we do end up with systems where, for example, in the case of goodwill accounting, managers have considerable flexibility in timing when they recognize the expenditure for one of the most expensive items in the context of their doing business. So it's really important that we bring that spirit of debate into these conversations.
Okay, so let me just voice the opinion of listeners out there who might be thinking or saying to the radio, well, of course this is what happens. Of course this is what happens. Because, I mean, another way of putting it, and maybe this is just a less charitable interpretation, is that you may say it undermines the spirit of capitalism. Others say, well, that's what equals a broken democracy right now, when we have, you know, the small number of people who are making critical decisions for the rest of us. And, you know, I was looking at some data here because numbers tell us a lot. Last year, 2014, there was a paper out of Princeton and Northwestern by Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page. And they took a close look at almost 1,800 policy decisions that Congress made, not even specialized boards like the accounting rulemaking boards, but Congress made over the last 20 years, and who influenced those decisions. And their conclusion is, quote, "The preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy." So this gets me back to what you were saying a little earlier, that oftentimes for these really complex issues, there's no one sitting on the other side of the table from these experts, right?
So that's right.
How do we, what incentives can we create to get people on the other side of the table who would be speaking on behalf of, you know, the other 7 billion of us?
That's a great question. And it's something that I've been trying to think a lot about since I've written this book, because I think it's really important that we change these institutions in a way that works for the overall structure of the economy. Now, if you look at the kind of specialized boards that I study, there's a tradition of sending so-called professional fellows, because this is the accounting standards regulatory infrastructure. The professional fellows tend to come from the large audit firms. And in the United States and in the world today, we have 4 large audit firms. And these audit firms tend to send professional fellows on rotation to these boards and to these regulatory institutions, where they play a very important role. They bring this kind of specialized expertise. But of course, if you spent your career in an audit firm, you tend to view the world in a particular way. Now, if, for example, for every one of these professional fellows we bring in from an audit firm, we also bring in a really smart public policy graduate, say, for example, from the Harvard Kennedy School or the Princeton Woodrow Wilson School or one of the other great public policy schools around the country, like Brown, etc., can we, for every one of the professional fellows coming in from the audit firms, can we bring in a smart public policy, public-minded individual to ask difficult questions, to simply sit across the table and question assumptions? Now, it's possible that, you know, these fellows, these, we can call them public spirit fellows, don't understand all of the nitty-gritty, don't understand all of the complex issues, but they're smart, and they can ask difficult questions. So can we get the same institutions that sponsor professional fellows to also sponsor these kinds of fellows, to come in there and ask difficult questions?
Can we? I mean, is there any interest for an idea like this?
I hope there is. And, you know, I'm trying to raise this issue with as many people as are willing to listen to it in order so that we can build support. We can build the kind of funding that's necessary to bring in more debate into these tables, into these rooms. We also have to create a climate within these kind of regulatory institutions where it's okay to disagree without being disagreeable. Because sometimes, and this is something that struck me about a lot of these conversations, they're a little too genteel. They're a little too comfortable. And it's okay to ask difficult questions. It's okay to challenge assumptions, because that's how we advance our thinking. And we have to change the climate. We have to change the culture in these regulatory institutions where we're allowed to provoke that kind of debate, where we're allowed to question the basic paradigms that govern regulation. Mm. The more of that we do, the more effective I think we'll be.
You also, in the book, or previously have talked about the role of sort of reshaping things like business school curricula. And, of course, there's always the media's role in all of this. What do you think, last question, if I may, what do you think the consequences or the future holds if these thin political markets, as you describe them, if we can't make them thicker, more diverse, more boisterous? Like, what happens if the expertise still is limited to so few?
So the best case scenario is that we have limited instances of what we call regulatory capture, where the rules of the game are structured to benefit a few. And, you know, there we go through a period of maybe 10 years, 15 years, where these individuals are able to extract some benefits from the system before there's a natural correction or a natural course of events. A new generation comes in, new technology comes in that changes the rules in the public interest. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is perhaps that this builds up to a point where we get the kind of financial crises that we saw in 2008 or the kind of massive accounting scandals that we saw back in 2001 with Enron and WorldCom. Those kinds of crises can be very costly for the economy as a whole and, of course, for individual investors. Now, one advantage of the crises, and this is perhaps a perverse way to think about this, but one advantage of the crisis is that it raises the salience of these issues in the minds of the general public. So if you look at, for example, the rulemaking infrastructure for bank governance and supervision of banks, my sense is that before 2008, this was pretty close to what I would call a thin political market.
Right.
But since 2008, there's been a lot of interest and importantly, sustained interest in the nature of bank governance. to the point where maybe it's thickened that market. So the fact that we're making movies about the financial crisis to this day, the fact that people like Senator Warren have made their career by championing, a public voice in this space is really important. Because those kinds of intermediating institutions help thicken the market.
Mm. So Senator Warren would probably say that the problem was not enough people were listening to her before 2008. See, the thing is, and I'm going to just wrap up with this thought. I appreciate the idea that that crises raise the level of salience, but on the other hand, it comes at great pain for a lot of people who may not have deserved that pain. So, just a final thought there. But the new book is Political Standards: Corporate Interest, Ideology, and Leadership in the Shaping of Accounting Rules for the Market Economy. It's by Karthik Ramana. He's an associate professor at the Harvard Business School. Real pleasure to speak with you and very eye-opening. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, let us know what you think about these thin political markets as Karthik Ramana describes them. We're at radioboston.org for your comments. Stay with us. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.